easy, simple joy, momentary joy, not big, massive, important joy, just like tiny little bursts of joy, is the most freeing, healing, powerful thing.
Welcome to the Behind the Scenes podcast. This is Michael Golab. Today I'm talking to Jana Keel. Jana is an American actor. She plays assassin Jules in Amazon's Hannah, and she directed and produced her first play, Persephone, in 2021. We talk about how crucial it is to define what exactly success means to you, the importance of finding balance without succumbing to the average, the significance of playfulness, and so much more. A quick content warning before we jump right in. This episode contains references to self-harm and drinking. We also have a donation link in the show notes below now. It's called Buy Me a Coffee. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd be immensely grateful if you could leave a very small or big one-off donation, which helps us with the maintenance cost of the whole endeavor and just helps us continue making the podcast better. Thanks so much for your support. And now, I bring you Jana Keel. How are you, Jana?
I'm so good. I'm so happy to be here.
Why are you happy?
I'm happy because I love chatting to you, and I'm in my beautiful flat that I've just been decorating because I'm about to get a cat. So it's like a cat flat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's just Saturday evening in October. Everything is good. Life is good.
So... What do you love the most about working as an actor?
What do I love most about working as an actor? The first thing that comes to mind, actually, because there are other more kind of philosophical or intellectual answers to this, but the first thing that I think of is the fact that I've wanted to be an actor since I was like 6 years old. So all the time nowadays, I just think I'm 24 and I'm my all my younger versions of myself have lived their dream now because I'm an actor. I always thought I was going to be, I always planned to be, I always wanted to be, and that is actually what I'm doing, and that is a really exciting feeling.
Do you know why?
Why I wanted to be an actor?
Yeah,
I don't, it's so interesting. I don't think I know. I feel like I knew I wanted to be an actor before I knew anything else. So when I was like when I went into grade school, so age like six, like first grade, I remember, I think it must have been around that time in the summers, there'd be like day camps that you could send your kids to, just stuff to do in the summer. And I remember from that time in the summer, my parents would send me to like drama camps. So it'd be different stuff. It'd be like, I mean, now I know it to be like devised theater, or you kind of put together a play, or there was this one that I loved called History Comes Alive, where you were given like a time period in history and you learned about, so for instance, one year, I think it was like the American Revolutionary War time. And we were all kind of, we learned a bit about the time period. We were given different types of characters you could be, and you kind of came up with your own character. You had like characteristics and like a family connection and whatever. And then the counselors would sort of direct you through a day, and it was basically you'd find there's different museums and stuff in Vermont where I grew up that might kind of have historical buildings and things, and we'd be in those buildings creating scenarios that, and essentially just improvising all day. And I remember being crazy about it because it felt like I was just acting all day, and it just was like the best thing in the world. That was like a dream come true to me, just to be basically in this kind of fantasy world all day and get really into it, really into the story.
Oh, okay, so the playful element of...
Yes, hugely, hugely.
And what I hear is like a very physical, connection or need to do this.
Mm-hmm. Always, and it's so hard. I don't know. I'd probably have to ask my parents, like, when did you... like, when did I start talking about being an actor? Because I feel like I've always spoken about it. We used to play what we would call pretend, quote-unquote, with my friends, like my neighbors, when I was really little, like 6, 7 years old. Where we would just basically pretend we were like a family, like a domestic family, and we'd have like arguments, and we'd like, our dolls would be kids, like very kind of simple situations. But we would do it for hours, and I remember it being so fun. And I always did that, and I always, in sort of drama school terms, believing in the imagined circumstances, was just a joy always.
Yeah, it's so crazy. I feel like when I was a kid, I was always, when I was waiting for the bus or when I was waiting for something, I was reenacting scenes from movies. I'd always play like Batman and the Joker and everything, yeah. Every other part. Yeah. Or I'd be Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker and everyone. It's funny. I wonder if it's like a very like big part of all of us, this playfulness when we're kids that we then weirdly want to continue.
I think the camps feel like a huge part to me because that was the kind of thing I did when I was little playing with kids, but there was suddenly a structured environment to do that in, and it continued my whole life, you know. So every age there was a camp for me, or there was a, you know. And so by the time I was like 11, 12 years old, I was telling my mom like, I want to take acting lessons, like I want to take this seriously, like it just, wow. I was just so into, and like if I did a play at school, I would like bring my script home and like work on it really seriously. And like my mom, both my parents have been involved in theater. Like they both have kind of normal jobs. My mom's a nurse and my dad's a technical engineer. But my mom always did like community theater. And so she could tell I wanted to take it seriously. So I remember playing Robin Hood in school when I was like 12, and I bring the script home and I would like work on it with her, and she would be really, sorry, the lights just turned. Sorry. Just the light, something went out.
Sounds like a David Lynch film.
So yeah, I'd be like, you know, kind of saying the lines to my mom, and we would just be having these. She'd be like, okay, cool. Can you say it? And can you make your body more still? Like, can you connect your voice more? Like, why are you saying that sentence to that person? And we would have those conversations when I was really young. And I loved it. I got off on it. I was like, and I was so good at it. Like, that was a big part of it, actually, is I got so much feedback from adults being like, you were so great. Like, you know, being like, oh, I always, you know, people that, you know, knew me when I was young still are like, oh, I remember you in Robin Hood. And like, because I think I was really, in a sense, very precocious when I was young. I was very confident and very, like, self-possessed. I think that is how I would describe myself at that age. I think I'm also kind of bigging myself up a little bit by saying that. But I do think I was. I think I was very, like, convinced that I was good and willing to put in the work to remain good.
Where does that confidence come from? Is it from the nurturing from your parents who really believed in you? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. My parents gave us a lot of freedom when we were little. Like, yeah. I grew up in a very rural area, so there was a lot of just like we would go and play outside as long as we wanted. They weren't really monitored. I didn't. Specific things like I notice other girls, for instance, will talk about how like their parents, like, I don't know, picked out their clothes for them, or like, but from the time I can remember, I 4 or 5 years old, they would just buy clothes for me and I would just pick them out myself and dress myself, and they would never commented on my self-expression, which I think is a huge thing. Rarely, like, I remember cutting my own hair when I was like 11 and I was expecting a big reaction, and my mom was just like, oh, you know, I've always thought you look nice with short hair, like really very just like letting me grow in how I wish to. And I think because of that type of freedom, I didn't feel the need to like rebel really. I think actually what drove me a lot more with that type of freedom was then a need to be liked, like a need to, you know, if I could do whatever I wanted, what do you then want? What you want is acceptance and affection. And so I think the kind of performative acting stuff was like, I wanted to be charming, and I put a lot of effort into figuring out how to be likable, to get adults and peers to like me and think I was special or talented or whatever. I think that was that became kind of my focus, because I didn't have to worry about how I could express myself however I wanted. I wanted to make sure that my expression was like palatable for people, that it would, and a lot of people were charmed by it when I presented it like that. They'd be, oh, look, she's so like creative and funny. And
uh-huh. Do you ever lose that confidence? Do you ever feel like you can't do it or something? What, or, and if you do, how do you deal with it then?
Yeah, I think, you know, if I'm thinking about my childhood, like, you know, up until the age of like, I guess up until kind of teen years, that felt quite natural to me, that kind of outgoing, precocious character. And then around the time I was like 12, 13, 14, when this happens to all teenagers, you start to go more inward. You start to question how people, you know, you start to doubt yourself. And that hit me really, really hard. And quite extremely. So I feel like almost my personality split at that time. And I've struggled with that ever since, that there's this one part of me that's like the child, playful, like exuberant, you know, likable and excitable. Like, so I can be very, you know, excited by things, very just, you know, joyful with the world. And then the switch, and I guess it's, I don't know if I can explain why, because I think everyone has this. I think this is just sort of a byproduct of society. but I do have that other side of my brain that just goes into a very dark hole of, I have absolutely no power over anything. I can't offer anything. I don't have anything to contribute. You know, I'm a waste of space. Why would anybody want to talk to me? Like, very, very extreme. A negative, unconfident language.
How do you deal with that? What do you have any tools? How do you then?
So therapy has been massive for me for tools, because I started going to therapy when I was like 15 or 16, because I started having panic attacks around that time. And I think that was a big part of, like, the panic attacks were because there was something very unexpressed inside me. So I was suppressing all of this stuff. I never talked about it. So it would just build up and then it would come out, as like kind of basically like, this adrenaline and this panic. And I didn't know what was happening to me. I remember really actively thinking that I was being possessed by a demon that was trying to kill me. That was like taking hold of my brain and literally trying to like...
Oh, wait, you were 16 then?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Like, I remember being in a bathtub and having a panic attack and thinking that the demon was trying to drown me.
Really?
Yeah. And I always remember thinking that, like, how am I supposed to fight this thing that's inside me? Like, this is so hard. I mean, this is quite dark, I guess, but also around that time I started like cutting my skin.
Oh.
But I think it was the same thing. It was this need to like let out something that I didn't know how to express. So it was just like this pent up feeling, and that felt like a release to me. And I think the reason I was sent to therapy is because my parents saw that and they were like, she needs to go to therapy. and therapy has been like huge. It's everything to me, because what it gives you is exactly a space where there's language to discuss why all this stuff happens and what to do when it's happening. And for instance, one of the biggest things that first therapist said to me is, panic attacks are not a demon. They are, in fact, your friend, because they are telling you that something is not right. So the second you start to feel that, you need to really check in what is not being expressed right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that started a massive just kind of search for me that I'm on all the time now. So how I deal with this now is that I'm constantly, constantly inside my own head keeping tabs on, where do these irrational, negative, intense feelings, like when they come up, why are they coming up? What am I reacting to? What's triggering them? And that's so there's periods in my life where I feel very on top of that, in the sense, not that I don't have the feelings, but that when I have them, I can see them as just thoughts, and the second I recognize that they are just thoughts, then they kind of lose their power. But all sorts of stuff contributes to me not being able to do that. It's simple things like if I haven't had enough sleep, or if I'm hungover, or, you know, those really basic things have a massive impact on the strength of your own brain.
Oh yeah.
You know, if you haven't had enough sleep, the big thought in your head telling you that you suck and you shouldn't go outside, it's that voice is just a lot louder, and the brain that is trying to recognize that that's just a bad thought is weak and it's tired, so it can't really fight. So really nowadays I put all my effort into therapy, into the thinking, the learning about myself. And then on the flip side, it's all just physical. It's just about, you know, taking care of my body, eating well, seeing, you know, everything that humans need to feed themselves, fresh air, exercise, water, sleep, company, all that stuff is really a powerful medicine, and hard work.
Yeah, it's always simple things I feel that we underestimate often.
Yeah,
because it seems so simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, therapy, obviously eating, drinking well.
Yeah, sleeping.
friends, family.
Yeah,
so important.
Human connection.
I noticed when I work out, because I used to think that I just enjoy working out, but yeah. Recently I found out that I enjoy actually working out with other people.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I used to, during lockdown, working out on my own, I hated it, weirdly. So I kind of enjoy other people working out around me.
Yeah.
Even if you like, if we don't talk.
It's
kind of weird.
It's a community feeling. And oh, yeah. A thing that creates a community feeling is when you're in a room with a bunch of people and there's a shared goal or understanding. So yeah. In almost themed spaces, so a gym, everyone is there for a certain reason. There is a community sense. Or if you go to a restaurant, like there's this kind of shared, we are all here and getting something out of this, and you treat people differently than you would if you're just passing them on the street.
No, community is really important. Also, you feed off each other's energy in a, yeah.
Mm.
Especially like a place like a gym where everyone's got their own workouts most of the time and everyone's in their own bubble. Mm-hmm. It's still, you're feeding off each other's energy of, yeah. What advice would you give to your younger self then?
Listen to your mom. Actually.
Really?
I mean, like, she's so smart, and she said she saw, like, she had my number. She's always had my number. Like, she always knew exactly what I needed, and I resented it. Because when I was a teenager, in this time when I was really trying to avoid all this stuff, it was like the same time around when I was having panic attacks, and I wasn't really facing my own emotions. I would fill my time. I did so, you know, I just played sports. I played an instrument. I was always in shows outside of school. Like, so I was, you know, from, and I'd go to, and I was in school and I was good at school and I was, you know, getting good grades. So I was just doing. And then in the evenings, I would spend time with my friends and like never ever had a bit of downtime. And all my mom always said to me was just like, just have some time on your own. Like, just spend time alone. Just, you know, be with your own thoughts. Like, stop filling up your time. And I was so resentful because I thought she was trying to like make me, trying to get me to stop having friends. I mean, of course, that's not what she wanted, but she was so like, you know, I was so chatty and she'd always be like, just stop. Essentially, she'd be like, stop talking. And I thought she was trying to shut me up, but she could sense, she's a very intuitive, empathetic person. She could sense that there was like stuff I wasn't kind of giving airtime in my own head. And in the last couple years, you know, being an adult, having left school, living on my own, I really start to kind of crave that and require it. I can't exist without that downtime, without that time with myself, the reflection, the journaling, now I'm so careful about who I spend time with, how much I spend time with people, what activities I do. I'm very aware when I start to fill up my time with unhealthy habits, why that is. Like, I do go into patterns that are unhealthy, but never for very long. It's, you know, never like it'll be.
How do you snap out of them?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say how exactly, but usually why is that the thought like bubbles to the surface enough that there's something I'm afraid of or there's something I don't want to address. And I'm quite a high achiever, even in a emotional sense. So if to be like good at being a person, you have to be really like aware of your own fears and triggers. If I suddenly realize there's a fear that I have that I didn't know about and it's triggering me, of course, there's a period of time when I'm kind of being owned by that fear and I might be, you know, drinking more or like smoking or something. And then at some point, I'm like, hang on a minute, like, let's sort this out. I think I'd rather be well adjusted than avoid the fear. I have that as a very strong priority. Some people, their stuff, they just don't, it's too big to face.
Yeah. That, I feel like this is a big, big topic. Mm-hmm. I feel for all of us, because I actually heard this on another podcast, is that from a cognitive scientist who says that we're all bullshitting ourselves all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and it's kind of difficult for us to confront certain things that we should confront.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how, yeah. I mean, it's all connected to seeing what's real or what's right in front of you and not how you want to see it. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how do you confront it? You just notice it and you notice that something's wrong and then you do something about it, I suppose?
Usually the only thing to do is to try and put words to it and try and make it, because fear, a lot of times fear or trauma, I was talking to my therapist about this actually a couple weeks ago, that sometimes I have this feeling like there's this thing behind me and I keep turning my head and it keeps moving, you know, so I can never quite look at it. And that's terrifying. You know, that's like a horror movie thing. And I was telling her, I was like, I just want to be able to just like turn around and look it in the face. Cause the second I can look at, see what it is, it's not that it can't control you anymore. You know, stuff can be big and scary, but nothing is as scary as not knowing what's wrong. You know, so like, you know, quite recently I was going through an experience where I was experiencing a lot of kind of what I would call nameless fear. And I could feel all my triggers coming up. I was reacting to it all sorts of ways. And eventually, I think through kind of therapy and through her kind of pushing me to go, I think something's going on. And I was like, nothing's going on. And she was like, I think something's going on. And eventually I was like, okay, maybe something's going on. And then just that there, it just is, you have to be brave. You have to trust that you're not going to die if you face the thing you don't want to think about. You just have to trust that this thought might arrive in your head and it might feel horrible and you might feel like, well, then this whole reality this fantasy that I've created is going to end. And you have to believe that just because that fantasy is going to end doesn't mean that you're then going to be like sunk into a dark pit and you're never going to be happy again. You just have to trust that seeing things as they are, even if it's not always what you want them to be, might actually be better than feeling really good but having a nagging fear somewhere in you that every once in a while rears its ugly head. And that is just, it just, like, what it looks like in reality for me is several hours of just like crying like a baby. And I try really hard, especially when that emotion finally just comes to the surface, not to stop it, just to really feel it and sit in it. And it feels like crying when you're a little kid, like that type of just wailing, but that your body, I think, needs to have that. I think my body needs to have that. And it's hard because all the feel, you know, you feel lonely, you feel lost, you feel confused, you feel, you know, like there's no direction, like there's no order. It's so hard. It's not like fun. But I'd rather that feeling than kind of walking around feeling like I'm trying to hold myself together and I might just fall apart at any minute.
Live a lie.
Yeah, like that type of falling apart is actually quite safe, you know? I'm not acting out. I'm just crying. Like, that's so normal and healthy.
It's probably helpful to have a good therapist, like you said.
I do have a good therapist.
Yeah. He kind of points it out to you, because we often, when we're inside a situation, we can't see it very clearly ourselves.
Yeah.
So family, friends.
Yeah, and it's exactly, it's not just therapists. It's important connections with people. Like, I make sure that the friends I have, who I let in on my kind of vulnerabilities and who I have an emotionally intimate relationship with, I make sure that I trust them. So that if they were to say to me, I think something's going on, if I'm with someone that I don't trust, I would go, you know, fuck you. You don't know me. You don't know what's going on. And I do actually, there's a lot of people that I would have that reaction to, that I kind of have a bit of an arrogant, like, you don't know me as well as I know me. But I have friends and I cherish them who I just trust. I trust that they will see something that I might not see because they're in tune to my pain. And because it's not theirs, they can see it clearer than I can. And I also try and return the favor with my friends, that I try and be very aware of what's going on with them, not to do with me, but just what is their kind of emotional landscape. And so, you know, so I can look out for them as well. It's a very delicate business because, you know, you don't want to go around telling people stuff that they don't want to hear. And you have to find the kind of balance of offering someone a, like, maybe you're in pain and maybe there's a reality that's not suiting you anymore.
Yeah, sometimes it's important to be a little bit indirect, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
With how you're saying it, because people, you can easily offend someone.
Mm-hmm. Or scare them, really. That's what's happening there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What would your main advice be to someone who'd like to succeed as an actor?
You have to really decide what you actually want. Because the phrase to succeed as an actor, you have to really decide what your definition of success is. Your definition. that's all the work.
Hmm.
There is, other people will have definitions and they will give them to you. You will have definitions that you've created without even realizing you've created them. And being honest with yourself about what that definition actually is really important. Because you could say, you know, I know lots of actors, we ask them, like, what would success be? And there's this line that's like, I would like to financially support myself being an actor. And then, you know, there's lots of follow-up questions. Would you like to financially support yourself as an actor forever or for 1 year? Or what if you do it for a year and then it stops again and then you have it, you're like, is that what you want? Like, what is financially stable to you? And then other people get to that point and they are stable, but then they're not happy because they're not getting the roles they want or they're not famous, or, you know, so you have to be so specific with yourself and really honest with yourself, because if you really truly want fame, and some people are scared to even say it because it sounds like almost you don't want to admit it because it sounds, I don't know, arrogant, or maybe it's an ugly wish, although it's a very common fair wish, and one that we're actually kind of fed. But anyway, you know, if that is what you want, being able to admit that at least to yourself is, you have to do that. So I can't tell someone how to, you know, I can't give any advice about how to become successful as an actor, because there's 1,000 different avenues and 99% of that avenue is chance anyway. You know, good timing, moment, whatever, it doesn't matter. I can't at all offer anyone advice about that. But what I can definitely say, because this is the work that I do and it really serves me, is making sure I'm very clear with myself about what I want, and if I get what I think I want and I'm not satisfied, admitting that to myself.
Yeah, it's such a big, I think I've said this before, I think this thing's called hedonic adaptation. It's when
like the sound of that.
What it means, I think, is that whether something incredibly amazing happens in our lives or something terrible happens, after a year, they've measured it out. After a year, the happiness levels of person A and person B are kind of the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So people get used to whatever happens to them, and then they're still kind of like, and now what?
Yeah. I mean, it goes into a deeper, you know, if you ask me, like, how do you become successful as an actor? Really, the avenue I want to go down is, like, do you want to be successful as an actor? Or do you want to be happy? Or do you want to be peaceful? Do you want to be...
Again, what's happiness mean, even?
You know, that's what I mean, is that the second, like, everything around the language around what do you want to do? What do you want? Who do you want to be? What do you want to do? All of that stuff belongs in the conversation of, on a very, this is how I relate to this, on a very spiritual level, what is it I'm moving towards? What am I seeking? And to me, I don't see it as some sort of holy grail at the end of the rainbow. It's a state where every moment, I only think kind of forward to the next couple moments of how can I feel kind of spiritually free and open and fulfilled and joyful and active and alive and all that kind of stuff. Do I want to have money, and do I want to have, like, stability? Like, yes, all of those things, but I'd put that in a different part of my brain. Like, you can't try and tie up all those kind of very material requirements for safety, very base safety, with your spiritual peace. I think you have to be aware that there's different categories of sort of achievement.
Yeah, and specificity in a way that you know what you want, and this, it can also change, and it will change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's a huge thing as well. Like, something that I am a very something I'm working on accepting is that I both put a lot of effort into really figuring out exactly what I want. Yeah. And I have to be very, again, it's about being very clear with myself and open with myself, if that changes, to try and catch that as quickly as possible, which can be, because your wants are so tied to your identity. Oh, yeah. So, you know, that thing you asked me about, like, what do I love most about being an actor? And the first thing I said was, like, because I wanted to be when I was a kid. Like, I do every day really have to contend with, and I, again, this is something my mother will often bring up to me, She's like, just make sure this is still the path you want, because just because you know, wow. She, and it's a big thing. And I do have to face it. And I don't really have a big answer for you. I can't tell you categorically, yes, this is what I want for the rest of my life. I can only say, yes, right now, I still want what I'm pursuing. There's other things I want to now, though, that I probably didn't think about when I was a kid. But the desire to act has not left. It's shifted, but certainly I have to, and it's huge because I was always the actor. That was always the thing from, you know, as long as I had an identity, that was a thing. So if I were to suddenly say, I don't want to do this anymore, well, that would be a big reckoning, I think. But I also don't think it needs to be a massive, like, you know, I throw in the towel and everything, my whole life changes. I think I'm shifting. I think it's morphing. I don't know into what, and I'm not trying to figure out what. I'm just trying to, you know, every step of the way, I'm trying to make sure that it feels good still.
It's something I ask myself as well all the times. It's like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And do I still want it?
Yeah.
And the answer's always different. But I mean, what I've found out by asking myself this question is that I know that one way or another, I'll always be acting or like playfully creating something. I know that this kind of fulfills me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whether I'm doing something else for a while or whether I, you know, whether I take some time off to do some thinking or mm-hmm. other stuff, I kind of know that I this is kind of part of me.
Yeah. I mean, again, acting itself, you know, you can make it a profession, you can make it a way to make money, you can make it a craft, you can make it an art form, you could just make it a hobby. If you just kind of let the concept of acting just dissolve into all sorts of various random bits of activity, you can part of it, you know, for me, yeah, absolutely, so much of that will always be the playfulness, the imagination, the fantasy world, the connection, the empathy, the storytelling, like all these different things are always going to exist in my life, and I can't really determine or try and force how they will be. I just have to be clear about the elements of it that are why I'm drawn to it, yeah. And make sure that those always remain in my life.
And there's so much curiosity. I feel like there's so much curiosity in this, like trying to find something, find out something,
yeah,
about a character, about
it's
a
like
story.
Like magic.
Yeah, yeah. Something that I think I understood very late is that there's the kind of, it never ends.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's why I call it magic, because part of it is in a, to really, I mean, this might be a bit of a like reductive thing to say, but like it's fun for this, like it's searching for the sake of searching sometimes.
No, it's not reductive at all.
Good. I'm glad you think that. I don't think it's reductive either. I just was worried it would sound reductive.
It sounds weird, but it's also what, God, again, these things sound so trite when you speak them out, but it's kind of also what life's about in a way. It's not about getting somewhere.
Yes.
It's about, God, enjoying the
process. Yes. And that's a really, like you say, it doesn't actually sound trite to say it. It sounds incredibly wise and clear when you say it, but also living that truth is a whole other ballgame.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I also want to believe, you know, it's just about the process and all this kind of stuff. And then, as inevitably happens with human beings, huge, deep, passionate desires will fill my body. And I'm like, I want this thing. And it becomes all about getting that thing. And not getting it is a disaster and is heartbreaking. And then it's those moments when you have to go, it's just a journey. Like, everything is a journey. So you have, like, you, this is a big thing that I do with myself.
We need some results from time to time, don't we?
We need some results. We need, well, this is, it's just about like
balance.
I try not to be so analytical that I remove myself from living. Like, I really want to make sure that I'm never hiding away behind analysis, that I'm also feeling and experiencing and fucking up.
But again, balance between the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if, yeah, one goes too much in
yeah.
either way, it's kind of unhealthy.
Yeah. Or, yeah, you kind of will compensate in negative ways.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite failure? Is there a failure or apparent
so
failure that
it's,
set
I mean,
you up for later
success?
All the stuff
I say about being all like, oh, yes, it's just a journey. But when you say the word failure, I get like a gut, like, sick feeling in my stomach.
We don't like hearing it. I also thought about this later.
No, but I love it. It's a, like, thanks for asking.
It's like, I'm not a failure, because that's how we feel.
Well, it's interesting. It's not even that. It's that I tie failure to shame so deeply. Like, the failures that I think, like, that kind of, before the literal memories even come into my head, just that the memory of what it feels like to fail is so big in my body of, and I know intellectually, so his light keeps just going out. It's literally just balancing.
It's David Lynch is in the room with us.
Oh my God.
He's directing this.
I need to, like, tape this together. Okay. Oh, failure. God, I had such a reaction to that. My favorite failure.
Something that you've learned.
Do you mean professionally?
Talk about anything you want to talk about. But what I mean basically is something that where you think you failed or other people think you failed, but you learned from it. And now looking back, you're like, oh, I'm actually partly glad that it happened because it made me into who I am now, or, you know.
So I'm thinking really hard because I imagine, because this is how my brain works, that there's going to be definitely like failures that I have like reframed in my head to just like not think of them as a failure. Like, I've probably already done that in my head, gone, just refused to accept that I feel like I failed and that actually I like, not that I meant to do it, but oh, it was never meant to be. It's hard in the acting industry because there's been a lot of times when I haven't gotten what I wanted and I've had to learn that it had nothing to do with me. But maybe that's not really a fail. You know, I didn't get a role I wanted, but that wasn't really a failure because...
Yeah.
But when have I really failed? Really messed up? Maybe this is not a really good example, but I'm going to use it because it's something that comes up a lot for me. In my first year of drama school, I was 18. I just moved from America to London. And I had wanted to get into, you know, the best possible school I could. And I was like, if I get into Lambda, I'm going. Like, I needed to have proof that I was excellent. You know, like, and I got it by getting in. And I was very, you know, so excited about it. However, also I was 18 and I had no way to understand what, you know, not only being 18 and leaving home, but moving to another country, you know, leaving a very small community that I'd grown up in. I had no way to predict how that was going to affect me. And how it affected me was that in this kind of quality, I have to be very kind of like accepting of all experiences and going into everything very fully. What I wish I had done was... Well, I don't know if I wish I had done anything differently. What happened is that in my first year, I partied a lot. Like, I drank a lot, wasn't very responsible, like, physically with myself. I would, like, you know, not take care of myself very well. And I was very, like, ooh, live free, like, hedonistic, doing all this stuff. But teachers, I got feedback from teachers saying things like,
partly what we all think when we become actors or like artists or whatever, like, I'm just free and I'm just going to express myself all the time.
But it was also, it was like my uni time. Like, that's a thing that everyone does in uni, right? Like, everyone drinks and parties and like sleeps with people. I mean, not everyone, but that is a stereotype that I definitely like acted out. And I mean, I can't really use the language that I regret it because I think that was inevitable that I was the type of person that I was going to go into that and do that. But where the failure comes in is I really lost touch with the part of myself that was like a hard worker and a good student. I felt that I was being disrespectful to my own work and I slacked off. Like, I didn't, you know, I would do the minimum amount of work and teachers noticed it. And they would kind of say, get your shit together. Like, clean up your act a bit. The sick feeling is actually the feeling that when I was growing up when I was like at school, like when I was a teenager, because I was such a good student, people expected really, like, teachers expected my grades to be good. You know, you do good grades regularly. And then if you drop them, they're like, you could have done better. And they know how good your potential. And at Lambda, because I didn't arrive showing my, like, I started out my experience there being very kind of half-assed with the work. It felt like the teachers didn't think that, I didn't feel that I was impressive or that they didn't, I didn't feel that they were even trying to hold me to a very high standard because I was showing them something quite mediocre and they were kind of going, well, we bet you can do better, but we're not going to push you. We're not your babysitter. Like, you know, it's a different kind of thing. And what I regret is that, and it's hard to regret it because I was fucking 18. Like, I know, you know, this, I don't think I would have ever done it any differently. Obviously, if I had, what I wish is that I had held myself to the high standard, that I knew what I was capable of, but that feeling of, I know I'm worth more than this. I know I can do better. I sedated that feeling with drinking. I like refused to accept that feeling. I was like, no, it's fine. Whatever. No one cares. And that really also lowered my self-esteem. And it really, like, because I started to just like see myself as lesser and not that impressive. And like, well, if I'm not capable of that much, I don't need to put that much work in. It doesn't really matter anyway. And might as well just give up. Like, I was much closer to that side of things than like the other side where I was when I was growing up and where I am now, which is much more, I want to achieve the best possible, you know, version thing that I can. And I'm going to put loads of work in to do that.
Yeah. So balance again. Today's theme.
Yeah. That's always my theme. It's my favorite and least favorite word. It's huge for me.
Why is it the least favorite? Because it always.
I often have existed in extremes and almost been proud of that as a character trait.
Oh.
And when people bring up the fact that balance is actually really healthy, I'm like.
But again, this is something that I used to think. Yeah, I mean, this is something that changed my perspective a little bit. Is that balance doesn't mean average. Like, I feel like think it means take 50% of that and 50% of that, because there are situations where you have to, God, let's just speak about acting, completely let go.
Yeah.
And not control. God, it's a bad example. Cause...
No. I know what you're saying. So what I framed it in my head, I came up with this like a couple years ago, and I to try and reframe balance in my head, I picture like a seesaw. Or like a I don't know if you know what a bongo board is, like one of those boards that has like a point and you balance on it with your two feet, or like a seesaw is a very obvious example. Where with a seesaw, if there's equal weight on both sides, it doesn't mean it's always just flat in the middle. It means you can tip all the way one way, but it also means you'll be able to go all the way back the other way.
Yeah.
If you tip one way and then take the weight off the side that's up in the air, you're never going to get back to the other side. Does that make sense? So I really try and think like that. Like, I can go to any extremes, but if I feel like the other side of me is like losing its weight, if I'm actually trying to like kill that part of me, then I need to make sure I go back to the center to find out where the balance, where the equal weight is.
Hmm.
You know, like, for, you know, as a kind of very blunt or a very like kind of boring example, like, you know, I'm totally happy to just go out to like a rave and like drink and party and like be really kind of irresponsible and chaotic, but if I'm only ever doing that, the part of me that's orderly and stable and, you know, has a routine and sleeps and takes care of myself physically, if I just start losing interest in that side, then I worry. If I just go, no, this is just what I'm doing now, and I know that next week I'm going to be waking up at the same time every morning and going for my runs, you know, I can. But it's about the feeling of, oh, what if I'm losing touch with that part of me that is capable of that? Because sometimes people will kind of party or have a more crazy lifestyle, and part of them will be going, I can't live any other way. This is all I can do. The other bit is too hard.
Yeah. So once in a while, it's important to like let the, whatever you call it, the animal have its party in us.
Yeah.
Like, to not be like very orderly, but to unleash it, if that makes sense, but in a safe way.
Well, it flips the other way, and I've had those periods of time as well in my life where I've been so kind of regulated and schedules and eating the right foods and being and doing all my work and being super productive and super organized and super like functional, whatever, and then being absolutely terrified to like drink or to like act out in any way because I'm so worried I'll never get back to the stability again. Yeah. That I will, like, you know, I'll just totally go off the rails and I won't be able to get back to it. So it's about the trust that you can seesaw.
Yeah, I guess the example I was trying to give is that when we prepare for a role or something, is that there's a lot of work to be done where you use your brain to do research, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but then when you actually act with someone, you have to let go of all of that.
Yeah.
But you can't like do the research and let go while you're doing research, otherwise you won't do any research. Yeah. And the other way around as well, when you're acting with someone, you can't be in control, because otherwise the scene will be
You have to trust your own
dead.
Expansiveness.
So again, this balance is a time when you have to completely let go and a time when you have to completely stay in your, you know, in your research mode.
Yeah.
But not 50-50.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. I totally agree with you. Yeah.
What would you say are the greatest mistakes that people make in the acting business? Apart from not knowing what they want, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big one. Not learning your lines. Just learn your lines. Just always learn your lines.
Yeah.
Just learn your lines. Just learn your lines. Just learn your lines. I don't know why that I say that. I think I had an acting teacher when I was a teenager who was like, that's 5% of your work. So if you can't do that 5%, like, don't think you're even getting to the other 95%. Like, don't try and pretend like you are if you haven't done that five. Like, do the 5% and then do all the other shit. And it doesn't matter what order. Like, some people have to do the, like, character work before they learn lines. It's not about that. It's more just about, like, learning lines cannot be... And, you know, I know everyone has a different, you know, some people, learning lines is a really big thing and it takes a lot of effort, but... Mm.
For me, for instance.
Yeah. But it just, you know, that's what we're given. Like, that's the fixed point for actors is the text, always. You know, that's the story. And it's, you know, film and television, when there's kind of like, you know, text might be written quicker or whatever, it might be different. But I just think, you know, that's what you're given. You're given words and creative work. The is the most satisfying thing to me. The work for the sake of work, for the sake of discovering stuff, is the most satisfying thing to me in the world. The thing that is so satisfying is the same thing that's satisfying about any type of creative energy. That's satisfying about relationships, about, I don't know, planting gardens, about having kids. I imagine I've never had kids. I don't know. This creative force that we have as humans to just the marriage of sort of magic and play and work and practice and repetition is satisfying, I think.
I love this creating thing. I think I've said this before again. I think it's in the Bob Dylan documentary on Netflix when I think someone asks him about the meaning of life or something like that. I'm probably completely misquoting everything. But he says something like, it's not about finding any meaning, it's about creating something and finding your tribe. That's what I really remember.
Yeah.
Finding your tribe, creating something. I think there's so much truth in it, like creating something. It does satisfy us, really, isn't it? I think it's this playful, childlike thing in us that wants to...
Engagement.
Yeah, this playful thing. Like, that's why it's so satisfying to watch animals play, dogs, cats, is because it's just constantly playing.
Yeah.
And we kind of lose that, I feel, oftentimes, because we become so absorbed in the seriousness of our existence
that
we lose this playful touch.
That's often something I crave with relationships or like any type relation, like romantic or friendships or anything, is being comfortable and close enough to someone and trusting someone enough that the kind of playful energy arises. That's just so beautiful, because it's no longer about a back and a forth, or it's just about, there's like a sense of something being created between the two of you, which kids have so much more access to, and our lives get so complicated and there's all this like shit built up in front of us. So when you start to trust someone enough to kind of let that stuff down, it's so, so beautiful.
Oh, trust, again, another big word.
Trust. Yeah, huge. That's huge. I mean, that goes back to all the stuff you were asking me about. How do you face fears? How do you, all that shit. It is all trust. You have to trust that you will just not fucking explode or die or any ridiculous, absurd thing that you think is going to happen to you if you face your fears.
How do you learn to trust?
How do you learn to trust? I don't know. I don't know. I thought about it. I thought about trying to answer that question, but I don't know. How do you learn to trust? You try and find it as much as possible.
So it's got to do with letting go, doesn't it?
Yeah. Try and find comfort as much as you possibly can, because comfort is the state of trust, I think.
Also because everyone's been hurt in their lives, I feel like we kind of close up a bit and we find it difficult to trust, but at some point we have to trust. And the question is how to let go. Trust has got to do with letting go. Sorry, I'm making this up as I go now. But I feel like, again, all the things we said.
How do you trust? Okay, here's an answer.
Friends.
If we are born with, if trust in a sense is the animal instinct that we are born with, which is about, you know, whatever baby, or if trust is when a horse is born and the parent knows to like lick the sack or whatever off of it, and then at some point it learns to walk, and it's just there's this intuitive understanding of how to teach its child how to, that in a sense is trust. It's not a thought out, I'm going to figure this out. It's just an instinct. If trust has something to do with that, I would follow through to say we are born with trust, with an inherent sense of trust that in some sense everything is as it is supposed to be. It is okay. We don't need to like do anything to make things better. Everything just will be. Now, then all of our work to learn to do that is unlearning. It's not about trying to figure out something we don't know. It's about figuring all this stuff out in the way of that thing we know already. So that's what I would say, is that we know how to trust. We know what trust feels like.
So like not trusting by adding stuff, but trusting by subtracting stuff. Yeah. And so unlearning, it's a big thing again. Therapy, friends, everything. Sleep, nutrition.
Yep.
God, yeah, there's big things.
And playing. Again, that's the quickest way to it, is if you can find out anything that brings that feeling that you had when you were a little kid and you played, like that just kind of unbridled playfulness and joy, any activity that you arrive at that can bring that feeling up for you, cherish it and find more. Like that's everything. Really, really invest time in that, because that's the other bit, that's reminding your body how to do it. You know, before we did this, before we started recording, I was in my flat by myself for like an hour just trying on clothes. And that's nice. That to me is an activity that just brings me absolutely unbridled joy. I've been doing it since I was little. I used to think I should be ashamed of the fact that I was so into clothes and how I looked, but it really wasn't about that. I realized I love dress up. I love colors and textures. And it's just, I just feel like a child, and I'm totally in a flow state. Just have so much fun. And so I just make sure I'm doing that a lot. Actually, in lockdown, I remember I got really depressed when I realized, because I was never going out anywhere, I never dressed up or put on makeup or whatever, all that stuff. So at some point I was like, I need to just, for no reason, this, you know, I'm not going to leave the house. I just need to fully go through the process of like getting ready to go out, because it actually brings, it's a huge, it's a massive activity for me. It's a hobby, basically.
And I feel as actors, we also really love dressing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's so on brand. Yeah. I mean, again, it's not just the clothes, it's the character. Like, who do I want to be tonight?
Yeah.
You know, I think tonight I might be this person.
This person. So, Jana, you're wearing a Vermont t-shirt.
A tie-dyed Vermont t-shirt.
Because you're from Vermont.
Because I'm from Vermont.
So everyone knows now.
I'm just repping. I actually wore this outfit a lot when I was home in Vermont, and everyone was like, you look douchey, because I'm wearing Patriots sweatpants as well, New England Patriots. I don't even follow, like, football.
Why is storytelling important?
Because you can access part of the audience that... the audience through almost their child brain, through the part of them that is not intellectual. And that's normally where fundamental change within us comes from. It's not something you can think your way into.
Wow, I love that. So it's like a direct connection to something that is bypassing the prefrontal cortex brain.
Yeah.
Mm.
And good storytelling will do that. So not every single story you read and not every single play you see will do that.
Mm.
And it won't always be the same for everyone. But the reason storytelling is important is we just got to try. We just got to keep trying. Just keep doing what we can. Keep trying to find ways to, you know, if as actors we are these kids who never grew up and we always like to play, our job then in the world is to just try and find as many ways as possible to touch that part of other people. Because that it is a special place and it is a very powerful place.
Is there anything you used to believe strongly that you've changed your mind on recently?
I used to believe strongly that if I was really skinny, I'd be more likely to get roles in the acting industry. And I don't believe that anymore.
What changed your mind?
I don't know. I think I got a role when I wasn't as skinny as I thought I should have been. That's one thing. But also, I think really the other answer is that I just decided I was not going to believe that anymore.
Okay.
Because on the one hand, beliefs are like truths that you think you have. And on another hand, beliefs are just things that you tell yourself.
Oh, yeah.
To don't decide believe, how you're going to live your life.
Don't believe everything you think.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I just decided I no longer believe that. That's just not going to be a thing that exists in my head anymore.
Oh, amazing.
And that is, I firmly have that now. What the reality is, I think fucking nobody knows. So, yeah.
Where can people find you? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
My home address is my phone number on WhatsApp is
wow.
My mom's house. No, I'm joking. I have an email address. Honestly, I don't like.
I mean, like, are you on social media? Let's make this simple.
I was really avoiding that. I'm on Twitter because I feel like I should have one.
Okay.
People should message me on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. I don't use it that often. Every once in a while, I tweet something that I think.
What's your name on Twitter?
I think it's at John Akeel, pretty sure. Every once in a while, I think I'm absolutely hilarious and I tweet something that makes me giggle. Other times,
I always do that as well. Peter, no one finds it funny.
No one finds it funny. No one finds it funny. But I kind of don't mind. Sometimes I just look through my own tweets. I'm like, ha, still good. Years later, still great. And then every once in a while, like, share, like, oh, my friend is in this thing. Look how cool they are.
Oh, yeah.
So social media just really was not good for my brain, and I have much more space in my head now without it. I am on Facebook, but don't find me. It's mainly so that my mom can see what I get up to. And I have a phone number and an email address, home address, and a local gym.
Well done, you.
Thanks, Michael.
My pleasure. So, actually, I'm going to ask this. What are the main things on your bucket list for the future?
I want to be in a movie.
Uh-huh.
I just really want that. I don't know how it will materialize at some point, but I want it. I want to be in a really cool movie playing a really fun role, and I want to have fun doing it. That's a 50% of that bucket list is that I want it to be fun.
How are you going to make it fun if it's not fun?
I'll just decide. Or I'll just decide, okay, I just won't be seeking my fun from this, okay. And I'll just wait for another opportunity. It's fine. I don't really mind. I don't have a lot of like, time sensitive, like I'm really ready for the universe to just hand me stuff when it happens. Other things on my bucket list, I would like to spend a period of time living and working in Germany. I don't know when, but I'd really love to like spend like a year or two maybe in Berlin and get my kind of German up to scratch. And
oh yeah, because you're partly German.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of get involved in the industry there. Just because I'd like to do that. I'd like to get in touch with, you know, that side of my identity. I was a little kid in Germany, and I have a, you know, strong connection to the German culture because my father's German. And also to German, like, art and cinema, because my dad, like, raised me on, like, you know, specific kind of important German movies and filmmakers. And that is something that I've always kind of been really excited about, and I'd love to be involved in the culture in that way. I have other things, but you know, I want to own a really expensive purse. Like handbag.
Are you serious?
Yes.
You want to own a very
own. I want to own, like, I want to buy and possess.
Why don't you just Do it.
Well, I could do it, but I don't want to yet because I want to like make it a big deal. I want to like maybe get a big job and like have a bunch of money. And,
I see.
I could do it now, but I shouldn't. I should be spending that money on other things.
On
or,
rent.
Like, rent or savings or, you know, my...
Because we're actors after all. Just, yeah.
You wouldn't believe it looking at the ridiculous flat that I've like decorated for myself. Yeah, which I'm absolutely enamored with. That's something that I totally feel like I've manifested is this beautiful flat with all my, you know, this beautiful furniture and... I love it.
Any parting words, last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Just play is so important. I just think about it all the time. I try, you know, I was about to say some sort of like deep philosophical or intellectual thing. And I do love all those conversations and really get excited by them. But I always try and get back to like just simple things, like you said, just playing, just like easy, simple joy, momentary joy, not big, massive, important joy, just like tiny little bursts of joy is the most freeing, healing, powerful thing. I think that's my offer. Oh, the other thing, I think Cher said this. I think I heard her say it on like Graham Norton or something, and I've been using it every single day.
Go on.
If it doesn't matter in 5 years, it doesn't matter.
Oh yeah, that's a very stoic. That's a, from stoic philosophy.
Okay, so it's not Cher.
It's not Cher.
Shut up. Well, it's Cher.
No, but it's not. It's
no,
just,
no, but it's.
But that, they say like think about it in. But it's therapy because most therapy is actually still drawing from stoicism Marcus Aurelius and Seneca is. Will it matter in 5 minutes? In 5 hours? In 5 weeks? 5 years? Fifty years?
On. Yeah. So that I use that almost every single day.
That's the
that question.
Different perspective.
When I have those moment, that feeling in my stomach of like, oh, I fucked up, or oh, I'm scared, or oh, this is bad. I really immediately go, will this matter in 5 years? Will I be how will I be thinking about this in 5 years? And it's such a I love it. Thank you, Cher. Thank you, Cher.
Thank you, Cher.
Thank you, Cher. Thank you, Cher. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks so much, Jana.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
This has been lovely.
It's been great.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you find this podcast valuable, it'd be amazing if you could leave a very small or big one-off donation, which helps us with the maintenance costs of the podcast and also helps us continue making it better. The link's in the show notes of the episode, and it's called Buy Me a Coffee. If you cannot donate, you can leave us a short 5-second review on Apple Podcasts and share the episode on social media. It really helps other listeners find the show. And make sure to subscribe to get the next episode. Thanks so much for your support.